couple of things happened at breakfast that I just wanted to mention. There's so many things that I really want to share with you in this session, and because my neurons of my brain cells are not what they used to be, I might forget quite a few, so I might just bring things in that seem a bit irrelevant from time to time in case I forget to tell you. Once when I was a child, I was sitting in the tram. I don't suppose, well, some of you would remember the old trams where you sit opposite one another. And I was sitting there, and a lady opposite me looked at me for a while and noticed her looking at me, and then in the end she said, "I know who you are. You're Dr. Donovan's daughter, aren't you?" And I very proudly said, "Yes, that's right," because I loved my dad and we had a great relationship. And a few years ago, he died some years ago, but I think 2 or 3 years ago I was looking in the bathroom mirror, which I do from time to time, probably not often enough, some of you may think, but nonetheless, Ruth says not often enough. Anyway, oh, that reminded me of another thing she said. We were sitting side by side one day and she looked at me and she said, "Your cheeks remind me of crumpled tissue paper." And I laughed, you know, I thought that was really funny. But anyway, a few years ago I was looking in the bathroom mirror and I thought to myself, "You remind me of someone." And then I remembered, ah, it's my dad. And it was really great to look in the mirror and be reminded of my father. That's true. I'm not a bit crazy. But this triggered to me. I thought, well, this isn't wholly irrelevant, because if you say to me, "Now, who are you?" I can say, "Well, I'm somebody's friend, I'm somebody's daughter, etc." But the main thing is I'm a daughter of the King. That's who I am. And if we read 1 John 3 and 2, this is the marvellous news, and this is what we've been getting towards all this weekend. "Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." What a miracle! And in some mysterious way, the hard, the painful things of our lives are all part of that process of making us, in this world, more and more like him. But in that day when we see him face to face, we'll be 100% like him. Isn't that marvellous? I was talking on this theme a few years ago. Actually, it happened to be a brethren conference at Tookley. And I mention that because you will be surprised at this, I think. That I was standing at the door and people were coming out and saying appropriate or inappropriate things, as the case may be. And somebody came out and said, "At last I know who you remind me of." And I thought, oh, I mustn't get too puffed up over this. She said, "Ronnie Corbett." I mean, the point is, we haven't arrived. We haven't arrived. And if I remind you of Ronnie Corbett, don't take any notice of my appearance. Just listen to the message that the Lord has for us. That was the first thing that happened at breakfast. All that was triggered in my mind at breakfast. The other was that somebody, whom I'm beginning to regard as a friend, gave me something really special. She said, "It didn't cost much. It doesn't matter how much it cost. It's really precious to me. My dog and I." And that reminded me of a meeting that I was at. It was actually the beginning of a seminar. People were introducing themselves and one woman got up and she said, "Well, there are three of us at home. There's my husband and the dog and me. And of the three of us, I prefer the dog." So I thought, well, I bet, you know, the dog lovers need to maintain a little bit of balance over these things. But, you know, Ruth says to me, when you come home, do you know what you do when you come home? You come in the door and you say, oh, the dear little doggy, what a dear little fella, how have you been? All this kind of thing. Oh, hello, horse. That's one of my names for her. So let's keep things in perspective. But our dog Toby, and if I've told you this before, please forgive me, but when anything hard happened to Toby, what he would do would be to lie on his back with his paws in the air. And that was a situation of being totally vulnerable. And I was thinking about that in connection with pain. When the hard things happen, our human reaction is to withdraw, to avoid the pain. But if the Lord is going to do his work in us, we have to be prepared to engage that pain. And that means being totally vulnerable, in a sense, being like Toby and lying with our arms and legs in the air, totally vulnerable, ready to receive whatever the Lord has for us. We say to missionaries, when you're in culture shock, it's really hard to engage the local culture. But there's been some work done that suggests that the people who turn out in the end to be the most effective missionaries are the ones who do go through the initial pain of engaging the culture. Those who withdraw into a missionary ghetto never adjust. So they never come into the effectiveness in ministry that they might otherwise have done. I think this is one of the most important messages of Job to us, that, yes, man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upwards. In this world you will have tribulation. But that tribulation is something that we're not to avoid or to hide from or to hide behind our layers with respect to, because that's something that we started doing in the Garden of Eden, didn't we? When sin began and Adam and Eve heard God's voice in the garden, they hid. And we've been hiding behind masks ever since. And I think one of the things that God's saying to us through the book of Job is that sometimes I just have to strip those layers from you so that you will be vulnerable enough to receive what I have to give you. So those were the two triggers from breakfast. I almost did it again. We're talking about willingness to be real, and in this book that I read recently, there's a quotation from Marjorie Williams' little book, The Velveteen Rabbit. Have any of you read this to your children? Great little book, isn't it? And it talks about being real, and I'll just read you this little part. The Velveteen Rabbit. The rabbit asks the skin horse, what is real? Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle? Real isn't how you're made, said the skin horse. It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real. You become real. And you and I become more and more real as we are aware of the fact that we're loved. We're unconditionally loved. And as we become real, then they're more and more enabled to become real for other people. And part of that, of course, is what Ruth was talking about this morning, Job being prepared to be totally, 100% honest and open about the things that happened to him. Okay. What I want to mainly talk about this morning is Job as a picture of the effects of major life change, major life transition. And I want to just share a little bit about my own story of what happened when I came back to Australia permanently after 17 years as a missionary in Papua New Guinea. And you might think, well, I haven't been a missionary, so this may not be relevant to me, but it will be, because the principles are exactly the same, whatever the major life transition. And I guess we've only worked out these principles in this century, but it's absolutely fascinating to discover that they're all there in the book of Job. So we'll begin with my sharing a little bit about my own story, and then we'll come back and say, well, how did the things that happened to Job tally with his story? And I hope it'll be of some use to you. When I came home permanently from Papua New Guinea, I came home because I wasn't particularly fit. After 17 years of being the only doctor and 24 hours on call, I got really tired and I wasn't well. I came home permanently. And I really looked forward to it, particularly 24-hour power and being able to drive my own car and eat apples. What a strange combination of things. But anyway, they were the things I really missed in Papua New Guinea. And at first it was great, you know, being able to go to bed and knowing that no one was going to ring me up about a patient. I wasn't going to have to get out of bed and do anything. But a few months down the track, I found myself becoming quite discouraged and depressed. And one of the main things that I felt was really useless, not needed. And the person that I used to think of myself as, you know, fairly easygoing and easy to get on with, seemed to be sort of...
Would you please turn the tape over at this point?
The person that I used to think of myself as, you know, fairly easygoing and easy to get on with, seemed to be sort of disappearing out the window. And I was becoming quite scratchy with Ruth and difficult to get on with and so on. And I was wondering what on earth was happening. About 12 months after I came home, I went to a seminar on counselling the bereaved. And as the teacher was going through the symptoms of grief, I ticked them all off. I had them all. So I thought to myself, oh, I must be grieving. And then I said to myself, well, what am I grieving about? And as I thought about that, I thought, well, what have I lost? I've lost everything that was in Papua New Guinea, the whole of my life in Papua New Guinea. And I've also lost everything that I thought was going to be. Cancer patients talk about sudden amputation of the future. We can all identify with that, can't we? Whether we're talking about a sudden bereavement or even retirement, especially premature retirement, retrenchment, unemployment, and we could list all kinds of things. They're all major transitions. So a sudden amputation of the future, and then I thought about the losses back here. There was the loss of things as I thought they would be. I had somehow or other thought, oh, coming back to my own culture, everything's going to be really easy. I hadn't allowed for the fact that everything here had changed and also the fact that I'd changed. So I couldn't sort of slot back into the place that I thought I might. But the thing that really got to me more than anything else was loss of what might have been if I'd never gone. And I thought I'd dealt with that well and truly before I went overseas. In fact, at my final meeting before I left, I sang that hymn that has in it, "Perish every fond ambition, yet how rich is my condition." And it didn't really worry me too much until I came back permanently and saw what had happened to people that I did medicine with. And then it began to hit me. Knowing what the problem was the first step, facing up to the reality of the problem. And the reality was that I would not be going back. And allowed me to get on with the adjustment. And something that I think that you said, Errol, before you sang. You know, we read the book of Job and we see that everything was restored twice as much as ever before to Job at the end of all this. And we don't want to run away with the idea that that's what's going to happen to us, because sometimes we have to face up to the reality that a death has occurred. And for me, the death was of those things that I talked about. and it seemed to be lying around my feet in ruins. And one of the things that I found tremendously helpful was the story of Lazarus, which I've referred to before, in John chapter 11. Let's have a quick look at it, because there are some verses I want to pick out that were tremendously helpful to me. And I can't go into all the business of Martha and Mary, but Martha was changing. Martha was a changed person since that first day when she'd opened her house to him, and Mary was there sitting at his feet and she was doing all the work. We haven't got time to go into that. But on this occasion, it's interesting that when Martha heard that, verse 20, when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him. But Mary stayed at home. And Martha said, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." And I was really saying, "Lord, if I'd never gone to Papua New Guinea, my life would not be in the shambles that it's in now. You wouldn't believe this. I can't tell you how often I have said to Ruth, I've blown my life. I've blown my life." And she'd say, "How come you've blown your life?" And I said, "I've blown my life by going to Papua New Guinea." "You mean you've blown your life by obeying what you believe to be the call of the Lord?" And sometimes we have to face up to these realities. And I think this is what Job was doing in some of the hard things that he said to God. So in this, what Martha was saying here, "If you'd been here, my brother would not have died. If you hadn't called me to Papua New Guinea, I wouldn't have blown my life, Lord." That'll shock you out of your pews. But that's what I was saying. "If you hadn't called me to Papua New Guinea, I wouldn't have blown my life." This is me in the middle of my dark tunnel. And Jesus saying to Mary, verse 25, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies." And then later on, he says somewhere to her, "Didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" Forget where that is, but it's somewhere around here. Doesn't matter where it is, he definitely said it. Okay. Somebody call out a verse? 40. Verse 40. Yes. Okay. Yes. That's why I didn't say it at this point. They go to the grave, the stone is moved away, and Martha says, "This man is really dead, Lord." And that spoke to me, because in Papua New Guinea they had, they distinguished between dead and really dead. Dead means they might come to life again. Really dead means they won't. And this is what Martha's really saying to Jesus here. "This man is really dead. There'll be a smell if you bring him out of the grave." And Jesus said, "Didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" When I looked at my life, I thought, "There's a smell about this, Lord. There are just ruins lying around here." And he said, "Didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" And then we see Jesus standing at the voice of the tomb, of the dark tunnel, calling out, "Lazarus, Kath, come out." And Lazarus, or me, coming out, but no, still wrapped in the grave clothes. And the grave clothes are very evident from time to time. And I find it so great, in the light of what we were talking about yesterday, that Jesus said to them, to the people who were around, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." This is the ministry that we have to one another, helping one another off with our grave clothes. Okay, there are other things that I want to say about that later, but I'm suggesting to you that this is a picture of a major life transition which we see in the book of Job. Now, don't be put off by that. I'm going to explain it as we go. How are we going? Yes, we've got time to explain it. As I thought about the things that were losses to me, something that Larry Crabb says was very helpful. Larry Crabb says that as humans we have two deep needs, one for significance and the other for security. In other words, we need to feel that we have a role. We need to feel that it makes some difference to the world that we're here. Okay? And when we have no role or we're deprived of a role, we feel really useless. And that's what I was feeling. And we have a deep need for security. We have a need to know that somebody cares about us. Maybe not five people whose eyes light up when they see us, but at least one. And widows have said to us, you know the thing that really gets to me, one of the things that really gets to me, there's no one in the world for whom I'm number one. And we can identify with that, many of us. And of course, as Crabb points out, ultimately these needs of ours can only be met in the Lord himself. Because in this world, roles can be taken away, people can be taken away. And I suspect that part of the reason why, when our role and our place are taken away and we're thrust into our dark tunnels and we're totally vulnerable, it's so that we will turn to him in a new way and we will begin to discover more and more that he is the answer, as he ministers to us in our pain. Now, a little bit of explanation. In any major life transition, whatever it happens, in any major life transition, whatever it happens to be, can I speak from here for a moment? Right. If you look at it, you'll see that loss of role and loss of place are major factors. If you think about your own particular painful losses, you will find that these are major components. And when we know our role and we have a place, what this thing means is that we can contribute. We can contribute out of our blessedness, if you like. I mean, that's what Job was doing at the beginning of the book, and we read about it in 29 or 30, whichever it was. Which was it? 30. No, 29. I'm glad Ruth told us where Job was this morning. Okay. 29. We read of Job's ministry, not only of the role and the place that he had in 29, but verse 11. Whoever heard me spoke well of me, and those who saw me commended me, because I rescued the poor who cried for help and the fatherless who had none to assist him. The man who was dying blessed me, and I made the widow's heart sing. I put on righteousness as my clothing. Justice was my robe and my turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy. I took up the case of a stranger, etc. He had a wonderful ministry out of the fullness of his own life. And then all these losses overtook him, and down he goes into this phase. Do you understand why I've got it like that? Yes, we all understand why I've got it like that. And this is the survival phase. A friend of mine relieved me once when I went on leave from Papua New Guinea, and 3 weeks after I arrived home, he was badly burnt with a kerosene refrigerator and had to be transferred back to Australia and had many, many operations. I went to see him on one occasion and said to him, "How are you getting on, John?" And he said, "Well, I'm really just living from needle to needle." Perfect description of the survival phase. I'm just living from needle to needle. Sometimes I'm brave enough to live from day to day. Sometimes it's just from minute to minute. That's what the survival phase is all about. And so if we think about the feelings of people in the survival phase who have lost role and place, what kinds of feelings might we expect them to have? Depression, despair. Job referred often to the terror, sleeplessness, nightmares. And so we could go on, and I'll look up some of the references for you so that we can look them up. Chapter 4, verse 5. Trouble comes to you and you're discouraged. it strikes you and you're dismayed. Chapter 6, verse 2, if only my anguish could be weighed and all my misery be placed on the scales, said Job. Chapter 7, verse 4, this will be one we'll identify with. When I lie down, I think, how long before I get up? The night drags on and I toss till dawn. We can identify with that one, can't we? In the prayer workshop yesterday, we were learning all kinds of tricks there. Thinking about people to pray for, go through the alphabet, all the A's and the B's and the C's and the D's and so on and on. But we can all identify with that, especially when there's some deep pain in our lives or some deep trouble that is upsetting us. 7:11, I will speak out in the anguish of my spirit, I'll complain in the bitterness of my soul. 15:13, this is one of your friends. Why has your heart carried you away, and why do your eyes flash so that you vent your rage against God and pour out such words from your mouth? It's interesting, when people are in their survival phase, their anger tends to be focused on whoever's closest, so that the doctor breaking the news of cancer to the patient may well be the recipient of that person's anger. And it's important to understand that they're angry about their situation, they're not angry with you. I found I was really angry with the mission. And Ruth would say to me, well, who's the mission? I go through various people and say, well, you like that person? No, yes, I like him, and I like him, I like him. But I'm really angry with the mission. And, of course, I was angry with my situation, not with the mission, but I had to find a focus. And both the people who are angry and the people who are close to them need to understand this, so that if we're the recipient of someone's anger, if they're in grief, recognise the fact that it's not you that they're angry with, and let it rub off you, let it blow off you. Okay. But the second thing, the search for meaning, no, I better not go onto that for the moment. Because of all these kinds of feelings, instead of having a ministry, there's a turning in on ourselves. And so people who are in the survival phase appear to be self-centred and preoccupied with themselves, and they are, because all their energy is going on just surviving from needle to needle or minute to minute. So we need to understand that and be patient about that. Instead of saying to one another, oh, she's so self-centred, she's so taken up with her own things, it's just because she hasn't got any energy for anything else. Please hang in there with her. There'll come a time when she will slowly, slowly be able to come out of this. And one of the stimulants to that is the search for meaning. Now, I've lost my pen and found it again. What is the person here calling out?
Help.
Help. And why? And where are you, God? Is it Christian? Okay. So the search for meaning is a very important, vital part of what happens to people in the survival phase. And if we look at the components of Job's search, and we won't go into details about it because Ruth did earlier, but I'm suggesting if we look at the components of Job's search, first of all, there was this longing to understand God's ways. Secondly, to find him. Oh, if I knew where I could find him, I would argue my case with him. Thirdly, to justify himself. I'm innocent. I don't understand why this is happening to me. And then I suppose bringing them all together to know him, if only I knew where wisdom dwelt. And it was a result of that desperate search for meaning, interspersed with all these hard questions and hard statements about God. Why have you made me your target, you watcher of men? Does it please you to oppress me? And hard statements, you've bound me, you assail me, you tear at me in your anger, you shatter me, you seize me by the neck and crush me. And yet at the end of the book, God says, my servant Job spoke what was right. So as Ruth's already said, it's okay to express exactly what we're feeling in the survival phase. And those of us who are sitting with people on their ash heaps, please don't be shocked out of your socks and appalled and driven to having God in a box by hearing all this kind of thing. Oh, there was one I particularly wanted to bring out. Just a moment. It really spoke to me, and I'll speak to all the musicians if I can only find it. Just a moment. We have to take a minute to find it. Here it is. Chapter 30, verse 31, describing Job's feelings. My harp is tuned to mourning, and my flute to the sound of wailing. What a beautiful description of deep depression and a kind of being locked into despair. That's how Job was feeling, and he didn't mind expressing it to God. And we've heard about the flashes of insight, and that I guess these are part of them. These are the flashes of insight which kind of lead us to believe, oh, at last we're beginning to come out of this phase, and then the next day we're down in the doldrums again, and so on. But eventually, one day, there comes a time when we get out onto the other side. New role, new place, new vulnerability. New vulnerability. And before we get on to that, I just want to say a little bit, to add a little bit to what Ruth was saying to us about the Lord speaking to Job, because when it's all said and done, the only thing that's going to get us out of the survival phase is when God ministers to us, and he does this in our own time as we are prepared to be vulnerable and as we continue the search for him. I became a Christian as a result of taking seriously, seek and you shall find. Nothing else would convince me, because I had scientific training, and I used to say if someone could convince me that God exists, I'd believe. Nobody could, so I didn't. But then somebody suggested to me, well, the Bible says seek and you shall find. That should appeal to you as a scientist. And it did. And I started seeking, and I found. And that became the story of my Christian life. All my discoveries about the Lord only made me see how much more there was to be discovered, and so on. This marvellous, ever-increasing vista as the Lord reveals himself more and more to those who seek him. If with all your heart you truly seek him, you will surely find him, saith the Lord. And that's another great message of this book. When we come to verse 38, when the Lord finally reveals himself to Job, there are a couple of things that strike me that I would like to bring out at this point. First of all, the Lord answered Job out of the storm. Chapter 38, verse 2. It was when Job was really in the depths that he was open to hear what God had to say to him. When we're in pain, we are desperate for ministry to us. And so it was out of the storm that the Lord answered Job, and he said, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Being interpreted, who is this person who is obscuring the truth about me by his own ignorance? And closely connected to that, brace yourself like a man. Now, I found it really helpful to hear Ruth talking about God's tough love, and I think that's great. Thank you for that, Ruth, wherever you are. Thank you for that. Another aspect of it that I've thought of that seemed really helpful is that, you remember in the Gospels, Jesus said to the disciples from time to time, there are other things that I could tell you, but they're too hard for you now. You wouldn't be able to cope with them. And I noticed as I'm reading Job, that two of the things that Job was preoccupied with in his search for meaning was the fact that God was the creator. His perspective restoration was to remind himself that God had created all this, and he was the source of all wisdom and power and understanding and so on. And the other thing, his search for justice. So that he was really stretched in those particular areas of his thinking. Somehow or other, the answer to my pain lies in some connection with God as creator, and it lies in some connection with God as a person who is just. So he's really stretched on tiptoe in every way. And I think this might be one aspect of brace yourself like a man, stretch yourself out to the utmost, and I will question you and you shall answer me. First question, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? That's an interesting response to all Job's hard questions of God. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? And to me, that's a marvellous perspective restorer. When here you are in the midst of your problem, and pain always constricts our world, does it not? And God's saying, I created all this and far, far more than you can possibly imagine. Where were you? What part did you have in that? Let's get this thing into perspective, Job. And the second question, which is prefaced by the same things, the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm, brace yourself like a man, I will question you and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? To me, this is saying, is your idea of justice better than mine? You've been talking about justice. And when we're in pain, the thing that we say is, this isn't fair, God. Why are you treating me like this? I don't understand this. I haven't done anything to deserve this. Why are you being like this? And so for God's response to be, is your idea of justice better than mine? Again, it's a marvellous perspective restorer. Don't you agree? Some don't. It is. It's a marvellous perspective restorer. And Job's response to these things was silence. And Habakkuk 2:20 is one of my favourite verses. God is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. And then coming back in chapter 42, surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. I was talking of things I knew nothing about, things far too wonderful for me. We need to understand that he said that while he was still in the middle of his pain, because he was a different person. God hadn't taken him out of his pain at that point, but he had revealed himself to him. And out of that came the ministry of the wounded healer. When I was desperately searching around for a new role after I came back to Australia, I was interviewed by a certain professor at Newcastle University, and he looked at my CV. I quickly learnt you had to have CVs in order to survive in this world, and he said, what about the gap? Somebody said to me, was he meaning you should go to Watson's Bay and hop over? I don't think he was meaning that, but that was how I was feeling when he said it, actually. But no, he meant the gap in my experience of Western medicine, and that was part of what I was blaming God for, of course, because I couldn't function at the level that I wanted to because of that gap. And when I went home and thought about it and complained to Ruth about it, and we clarified it together. I thought to myself, well, that gap is filled with something. And the question became the question of creative coping, which is, how can I make lemonade out of this lemon? How can I gather up what's in this gap and use it for ministry? And as I started to think about it, I thought, well, what's in that gap is fairly unique in this community, and somehow or other I have to learn to take that and to use it in ministry. So that for me, there wasn't restoration of all that had been lost, but there was a challenge to a different ministry out of the gap. I'd like to challenge you with that concept, because you might be like me. You might have in your life have wasted an enormous amount of energy being sad about the things that didn't turn out the way you hoped they would have. One of my great regrets is all that energy that's been wasted on that kind of thing. So coming through more and more to the concept that I am what I am now because all of the things that have happened to me in the past, good or bad. And interestingly enough, the bad things often have the more positive effect than the good things. So how can I, and I challenge you with that thought, how can you gather up what's in the gap, the what might have been gap, and the things that happened that I didn't particularly like, that I would never have chosen, gap, gather them up and use them for ministry. Does that strike any kind of chord? It was a real watershed in my life, a real change in direction in my thinking. And as I continued to search desperately and pray to the Lord about it, I began to experience more and more of the John 16:33 experience. In this world you will have tribulation, but it's not meaningless. Not meaningless pain. Remember that, girls? Remember that moment when you saw your baby's face for the first time? And if not then, a little bit further down the track, you said to yourself, it was worth it all. It was worth it all. To be able to take up the pain in that gap and use it for ministry. And I guess, I mean, for better or worse, this is part of that. This is gap ministry, folks. It may or may not meet any need of yours, but it's like my baby, you know. Somebody wrote me a letter and said, I read your book and I think it's a lot of psychological claptrap. And I was really shattered about that. Ruth had to counsel me for quite a while after that. It's like Ruth Witherspoon says, we remember the negative things. You know, Ruth would say, well, what about the positive letters you've got? No, they made no difference at all. That awful thing that she said to me, and probably a lot of the people who said positive things really were thinking negative things, and they just wanted to make me feel good. You know the kind of screwy thinking that we go in for? Yes. Okay, so where was I? Oh dear, that's where we are. Well, there were a couple of other things I want to say. I don't want to go without saying them. Where are they? Oh, I know. Just a couple of things about the gap. Not the gap. Survival. What are some of the things that help us through the survival phase? Where it's appropriate, of course, preparation. I wasn't at the retirement thing, but I'm sure that was a big part of it, that preparation for what's ahead and makes it so much easier to deal with that. But of course we can't prepare for some of the things like sudden bereavement. But if we can prepare, it's so good not only to inform ourselves but also to have some kind of closure and loosening of ties and so on. But the thing that really threw me for a while was the absence of this. That's the funeral. see, I was in my survival phase thing. Well, when I feel better, maybe I'll go back, or maybe I won't. Of course, being a missionary is best, and everything else is second best. And now that I'm here, I'm out of the Lord's will for me, even though at other times I'm saying I blame my life and it's God's fault. It wasn't until I faced the reality that I probably wouldn't be going to go back and had a funeral that I was able to face in the right direction and get on with the rest of my life. The funeral is therapeutic. It's a symbolic recognition of the fact that a death has occurred. A real death has occurred. And now I must get on with everything that I have and am as a result of that death. An uncle of mine at my mother's funeral turned to me while we were just the two of us standing and looking at flowers, and he said, "And so we live on." It's easy. It's easy for us to get stuck here because we're in our minds living back there. But that hinders us from receiving what God has for us now. Sometimes we need to do that. You know, cancer patients will go into denial, and that's good, that's fine. And people who've suddenly been bereaved will go into denial. But you can't do it forever. If you do it forever, you're not going to receive what the Lord has for you. And so movement onwards is very important. And recognising the fact that we're not going to leave all this behind. We're not being disloyal to all that. All that is alive and well in me, and it always will be. Everything that I am now is a result of everything that happened back there. So I don't have to feel I'm being disloyal or I'm discarding what was in the past. No, that's all part of the movement forward. With every loss is the possibility of transcendence of that loss. But in transcending that loss, we take with us everything that was. But hopefully, we deal with all the unfinished business that's hindering us. And this is why when my dad died, it was 3 weeks after I arrived in Papua New Guinea, and I dearly loved him, and it happened quite suddenly and unexpectedly, and yet I was able to grieve for him without any problem. My mum and I didn't get on too well, and that's when I had my anxiety reaction. It took me years to get over my mother's death because I wouldn't deal with the unfinished business. And part of it, again, my chief counsellor, Ruth, helped me to come to grips with the fact that I hadn't realised, I suppose I should be stopping, but I'll just tell you this quickly, that the only reason I'm here, folks, is that my eldest sister died of leukaemia about 3 months after I was born. They decided to have me because they knew she was dying. And that makes me feel rather funny. Nonetheless, it wasn't until I realised how my mother must have felt, about me, and she was manipulative, overprotective. Well, that's easy to understand, isn't it? Imagine how you'd feel about that little baby. And that kind of messed up our relationship. And in retrospect, I'd love to be able to go back, but of course we can't. But I've gone back in my mind and put things right with my mum. But anyway, because of the faulty relationships back there, it was much harder. But there was an end to it, of course. We don't have to think, I had a bad relationship with someone back there, therefore I'm never going to get over this. It's not true. We can do the work that we should have done back there, down here, and then proceed. Okay, but that was one thing that I wanted to say. And the other was just a summing up, if I can find the bits of paper. Yeah. Just very briefly, a summary of why Job was written. First of all, so that we face up to the reality that tribulation is a fact of life, we're going to have it, and so we don't need to feel that we're being treated unfairly when it comes. Secondly, that it's quite legitimate to feel pain when we've undergone devastating losses, and therefore it's legitimate to express how we're feeling. And we need people beside us who will say, "It's okay. No wonder you're feeling the way you're feeling. It's extraordinary the number of people still who think there's something abnormal about them and who feel terribly guilty because they're feeling the things they're feeling. If there's anyone like that here, stop immediately. Think about Job and all the things he expressed. It's okay. God says it's okay. Everything that Job said, even the worst things that he said, are okay. As Job says to his friends, I'm crying out because I'm in pain. And we need people to tell us it's okay, to reassure us. Thirdly, to recognise that pain constricts and distorts our world so we can't see things clearly. We will become a bit self-centred because we need that energy simply to survive. And people need to be able to bear with us through our self-centred phase and recognise what's behind it. Fourthly, that we can say, well, I'm glad I feel pain. This is further down the track. I'm glad I feel pain because it prodded me to search for God that I wouldn't ever have embarked on otherwise. And don't draw back and put God in a box. Engage your pain. Go for it. Search. Face the reality. Let it do its work in you, because we know that in the end, God himself is going to reveal himself to us in a special way. And we'll be able to say, like Job, I was talking about things I knew nothing about, things far too wonderful for me. Let's just bring this to a close by reading again Psalm 18. And the last thing is, while we're looking for that, to remember that God is behind this, whatever the thing is, and God is trusting me with this unexplained thing. His honour is at stake in this. He not only trusts me with it, but he empowers me to be trustworthy. And when we see him face to face, we'll understand that it was worth it all. Psalm 18, verses 16 to 19. And we can rely on this. We can rely on this 100%. David, speaking out of a dark tunnel of his. He reached down from on high and took hold of me. He drew me out of deep waters. He rescued me from my powerful enemy, from my foes who were too strong for me. And often they're my own thoughts, my foes that were too strong for me. They confronted me in the day of my disaster and said, "You're guilty. Christians shouldn't feel like this." But the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a spacious place in my thinking, in my spirit. He brought me out into a place where I'd never been before. He rescued me. Why? Simply because he delighted in me, because he looks at me and says, there's no one like her in all the world. I am his treasure. Can't I trust him enough to know that one day when I see him face to face, I will be like him, and I will know him even as I am known, and I will find a treasure far beyond my wildest imaginings. Anderson spoke a true word when he said, Job is one of God's best gifts to man. Go home and read it, and you're certain to be blessed. James 1:25, and I really am finishing on this. James 1:25, remember this whenever you take up the scriptures. I can't find James. Where is it, Ruth? I don't know. I need to have Ruth around me to tell me what to do about things. Okay. Verse 25, and this has been such a blessing to me over the years. The man who looks intently into, same word as when Peter and John ran to the tomb, saw it open, looked intently into. You can imagine with what attitude they looked intently into that tomb. But the man who looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues to do so, the thought is of cultivating a lifelong relationship, as in a marriage, not forgetting what he's heard but doing it, he will be blessed in what he does. We read this book, Job, and apply it to our lives, we will be blessed. There is no question at all about it.